Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 7th, 2024. Well, Canadians trying to reconcile the country's performance on the world stage these last months and years may be suffering cognizant dissonance. Aren't we, after all, the good guys? You wouldn't know it watching our parliamentarians salute Ukrainian proto-Nazis or the government aiding and abetting their Banderite successors. Yes, this great white North is definitely not your great-grandfather's. But when it comes to refusing to condemn the purveyors of ethnic cleansing and openly supporting a colonial, racist genocide, today's Canada is starting to look a lot more like his great-great-grandfather's. Nick Gottlieb is a climate writer based in northern BC and author of the Sacred Headwaters newsletter. Nick's also a community organizer and graduate student at Simon Fraser University, whose studies focus on the politics of climate change, colonialism, and imperialism. His articles appear too at CanadianDimension.com, where I found his latest piece, Canada Has Gone From Complicity Through Silence to Active Participation in Genocide. Nick Gottlieb in the first half. And citizens of towns and cities around the world have gathered weekly in solidarity with the people currently being butchered wholesale by the Israeli war machine in Gaza and harassed by organized thuggery in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the bombs, bullets, and bandages necessary for Israel to continue the carnage are being supplied by the factories of countries like Canada and Germany, the Netherlands and UK, in the United States, prime supporter and supplier of the current horror. One determined group decided to take its protest from the courthouse steps to the gates of the local munitions factory, putting their bodies in the path of the satanic meal they call the slaughterhouse. Nick Moturn is a journalist, author, and co-coordinator with Kathy Kelly of BanKillerDrones.org, an organization founded to, quote, inform the American public about the illegality, immorality, and dreadful human consequences of U.S. drone attacks. His articles appear across the internet and at covertactionmagazine.com, where I found his recent piece co-authored with Veterans for Peace activist Jack Gilroy, Welcome to the Slaughterhouse, Nick Moturn and Reading the Government, the Leahy Act in the second half. But first, Nick Gottlieb and Canada's transformation from silent partner to vociferous participant in genocide. Well, welcome to the program, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Nick, a lot's changed since your article came out at Canadian Dimension way back on January 16th. And one of those stories is something that I've been following all weekend, and this was the scandal of the NDP Provincial Minister for Secondary Education, Selena Robinson. You've got a post up right now on your Twitter site, N. Gottlieb Photo. Do you want to talk about that post first before we get started?
Yeah, you're referring to the one where I was critiquing Rob Shaw's claims about the Jewish community?
No, I'm not actually. But we can talk about that too. No, I'm talking about the BC political media and the NDP been very carefully avoiding mentioning any of the labor groups that called for Robinson's ouster or the allegations of abuse of power they raised. And there's other organizations. You've got a litany of organizations that came out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure people have seen the news stories about Selena Robinson and the way the media is framing it. She has been sort of pushed to resign her position as cabinet minister or removed by EB. It's not totally clear. Primarily because she referred to Palestine as a crappy piece of land, which, of course, she did. It was disgusting. And that was part of this whole story about she was justifying Israeli genocide by using the sort of like classic Lockean concept of terra nullius to say like, oh, they weren't really using the land, so then we had the right to improve it. So the media is reporting on it as though she was fired just because of that. And that's part of it, right? Like someone who espouses those views absolutely shouldn't be the minister of post-secondary education just because of the implications of what that means for our post-secondary education. But it was a lot more than that. And a lot of the, like, a number of Muslim organizations called for her ouster, but really critically, a number of post-secondary labor organizations called for her ouster. And they did this because, at least according to them, and according to herself, really, in some of the things she said, she intervened to have Natalie Knight fired from Langara College after Langara had conducted their own investigation into Natalie and cleared her and decided to reinstate her position from a suspension. And so, you know, these labor organizations, as well as Independent Jewish Voices, which I'm part of, and a bunch of Muslim organizations, called for her ouster not just because of her sort of her views, which is what the right-wing media would tell you, is that the woke mob came for Selena Robinson, but also because she abused her ministerial privilege to have someone fired. It's just totally unacceptable for the Minister of Post-Secondary Education to be intervening in faculty decisions at an individual university level.
Well, her positions on Palestine, to begin, as you mentioned, and the terra nullius argument, you know, a land without a people for a people without a land, is a trope that decades old about the founding formula in Israel, or the myth of it at least. And it betrays a certain ignorance of history and even geography for her to say that. But the way that she said it so publicly and so proudly was the feature that really amazed me, that she could repeat this on a public forum, and she herself being in a position where she is a part of the provincial intelligentsia, right at the pinnacle of the education ministry. That always struck me. But the fact that she would also, in a tweet, go on to incriminate herself by saying, "I went and talked to the Langara people about this woman, this Dr. Natalie Knight, and, you know, how I was unhappy with her being there." This is such an obvious overstep and abuse of the power of her office. But for her to come out publicly and state that, I wonder if this woman has the intellectual capacity, the wattage to light a Christmas tree bulb.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. Right. The reason we know so clearly that she did this is because she bragged about it. which is wild, and it makes it all the more wild that you know, EB has refused to say that he asked her to resign because of her ministerial misconduct. Instead, he's made it this sort of thing about how she, you know, he refuses to mention the word Palestine, but makes it all about her sort of Islamophobic anti-Palestinian views, and totally ignores the additional problem that she just did something wrong as a minister.
Well, and I wonder about the legal ramifications of this. I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't, and nobody's told me whether or not this is a violation of the law in this province for a minister to use or misuse their power and authority in this manner. But I imagine that at the very least that there would be grounds for some kind of civil litigation. Have you heard anything about Dr. Natalie Knight, since? Like, I'm looking, but I haven't seen any comment from her since the resignation. Have you?
I haven't seen Knight comment. My understanding is that the FPSE, Federation of Post-Secondary Educators of BC, is, now that Robinson has been removed, they are seeking to hold Langara College for accountable. And so there may be some legal action coming from that, but I don't have any internal insider knowledge.
Well, now I can understand why the premier would be trying to downplay this as much as he possibly can do. But in your tweet, you also say, you point a finger at the media in the province. Why would they be interested in obfuscating this aspect of Selena Robinson's misconduct?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things going on there, I think. One is, you know, even at the national level, right-wing media has jumped on this as sort of a claim that the woke mob has come for the Jewish legislatures. It's just absurd stuff. But Zionist lobby groups are claiming anti-Semitism against Selena Robinson, all this other stuff. But then at the provincial level, you know, we have like a burgeoning independent media environment, but they're all small, right? I mean, the Taiyi, the Narwhal, a bunch of others, and they've been to the extent that they cover these issues, they've been pretty good. But the like main legislative press corps is this group of people on Twitter have been calling them Team Access, and they're journalists that have sort of given up the call of being a press corps journalist, you know, where you're supposed to like ask hard questions and be difficult for the politicians, and instead they're sort of chummy with them. They go to events with them. They hang out with them. They're friends with them. And so at least a lot of the people on Twitter are attributing some of this response to that, which is just that these journalists are friends with Selena Robinson, many of them. And, you know, I think it's also more than that. It's that they represent the status quo, right? I mean, whether it's the NDP or the BC United, BC Liberals, whatever it is tomorrow, these journalists and the outlets that they work for, which are, of course, largely owned by Post Media, they're not interested in supporting things that challenge the status quo. And of course, the removal of Selena Robinson challenges that in multiple ways. One, because it's possibly the first time anyone's been fired for, at least from a position as public as this, for anti-Palestinian racism. So that's sort of a really big step. And second, because it demonstrates the power that sort of we, the public, and especially the public on the left, have for maybe the first time in many years.
Well, yeah, when you talk about this, the access journalist or salon journalists, as I like to call them, I've been going down to the demonstrations. I live in Victoria. I go every Sunday now for these last months to rally and demonstrate in support of Gaza and Palestine. And on a couple of occasions, on the very front steps, the parliamentary reporter Keith Baldry has imperiously marched right along the very front, you know, right through the main body of the protesters, you know, where the banners and everything are. As far as I know, though, I've never seen him stop. I've never seen him interview anybody. I've never seen him show anything other than a thinly veiled contempt for the proceedings in front of him. Do you know, have you ever, I got to admit, I don't watch CTV anymore, if that's who he still works for, but I don't watch it anymore. But have you seen any coverage from Baldry or his ilk of the demo in front of the week?
I haven't. I mean, I also don't really watch the TV news. I did see a clip of Baldry talking about Selena Robinson's ouster, and he sort of flusteredly expressed his distaste for the fact that what he described as unelected people were making decisions in the conference. Of course, he was referring to activists, which is kind of hilarious. Yes.
The rabble. What do they have to do with democracy anyway?
Exactly.
Well, when you mentioned the status quo and what the status quo might be tomorrow, looking at the Selena Robinson, I had a moment to pause with optimism, the first optimism I've had around this whole issue for a very long time, that it shows a chink of vulnerability in the political and media armor that surrounds everything to do with Israel. And of course, this country's complicity in it, which is the nexus of your article that we're ostensibly here to talk about. And that's Canada has gone from complicity through silence to active participation in genocide. Do you share my optimism that this Robinson affair could be the beginning of something bigger, where we see political figures in this country held to account for their egregious positions, I would posit, on the war and genocide going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope so, right? The answer that I really ascribe to, I think, is a bit longer than that, which is that we're going to see a huge amount of backlash to this. We already are over the last couple of days. And, you know, I spoke at a labor event in Vancouver a few months ago, and it felt like repression of protests at the time was really ramping up. Like someone had been arrested in Edmonton for chanting, you know, from the river to the sea. The Toronto activists were arrested and charged with like conspiracy, all sorts of mischief over 10,000. All this sort of political repression was really ramping up. And while that's scary as activists and as writers and everything, I think it's also a sign, as this Selena Robinson incident is, that we have more power than we've had in years, right? I think political freedom comes and goes based on the perceived threat to power that the capitalist class has. So when they don't see any threat from labor, from left-wing organizing, from anything, then yeah, we can say whatever we want. We can stand in the street and shout things. And then when they start to feel threatened, that's when we start to see repression ramp up. So the signs of repression ramping up are signs that they're more threatened than they've been in decades, you know, since the end of the Cold War or earlier even. And I think that's a really optimistic sign, as much as it is also a scary sign and a warning of what we need to be vigilant against. And I think the Selena Robinson incident is the same thing. It's you know, a really optimistic sign. This is, as I mentioned, probably the first time that anyone from a public office has been forced to resign because of anti-Palestinian racism in North America, at the very least. And so those are all really promising signs, but they're also warning signs that we're in the process of there's sort of a huge wave of repression that's just gaining steam. And where it goes depends on that battle between us and the capitalist class.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Nick Gottlieb. Nick's a climate writer. He's based up in northern BC. He's the author of the Sacred Headwaters newsletter. He's also a community organizer and grad student at Simon Fraser University. He studies politics of climate change, colonialism, and imperialism. And his articles appear online at CanadianDimension.com and his website. I found his article, Canada Has Gone From Complicity Through Silence to Active Participation in Genocide, at CanadianDimension.com, a very good site. I recommend it. Nick, now, about the article, and just this concerns Canada's cooperation in the, as the Department of Foreign Affairs would have it, in Operation Prosperity Guardian, currently going on in the Red Sea and escalating even as we speak now. For those that only watch the television news, perhaps, just happened upon this podcast by accident, what is Operation Prosperity Garden for a Guardian, first of all?
Yeah, so the Houthis, also known as Ansar Allah, are sort of the leaders of a large portion of Yemen. They've been involved in a civil war in Yemen, but also a proxy war with the U.S. vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia for over a decade. And they are also, Yemen in general is a very pro-Palestinian country. And so the Houthis, I believe in end of November, maybe early December, began a blockade in the Red Sea, blocking the Suez Canal, that would prevent any ships that were affiliated with Israel or going to Israel from traveling through. They have had a pretty significant material impact on global trade. Some ships are still going through. Many ships have rerouted, and rerouting involves like an additional 10 days and thousands of miles of extra travel. And so, in many ways, what they're doing is along with, I guess, the actions of Hezbollah in Lebanon, those are the only two sort of military forces that are engaging in any meaningful way, in any material way, to stop the ongoing Israeli genocide against Palestine. And of course, the U.S., Canada, the West in general responded to that by talking a lot about the so-called rules-based international order and sort of emphasizing the importance of free trade as they are wont to do. And so they responded by creating this Operation Prosperity Guardian, which was supposed to be an effort to protect ships traveling through the Red Sea and halt the Houthi blockade. They have now... I think both within the bounds of Operation Prosperity Guardian and then also within some other umbrellas, Task Force 150 is a U.S. and sort of multinational task force that's been operating in the region for some time. Canada is a big part of that. A lot of the attacks are going on under that umbrella, not under Prosperity Guardian, but it doesn't really matter. So since then, the U.S. has bombed both, they've attacked ships in the Red Sea, but they've also bombed land targets in Yemen multiple times with Canada's support. And there's a sort of great clip of Biden being asked about this not too long ago. And somebody asks, are the airstrikes against Yemen working? And Biden responds and he says, by working, if you mean that the Houthis have stopped attacking ships going through the Red Sea, no. Will they continue? Yes. Yeah. So, it's just a sort of like absurd theater that involves blowing up people's homes and killing people in the Middle East just to save face. And for some reason, Canada is taking part in this.
Well, now the ministry responsible, the foreign affairs, they say that there's no Canadian ships involved in this or aircraft even. They've just got a few officers helping out, I'm not exactly sure what they're doing.
To your point about how many Canadians are involved, I think there's been a bit of obfuscation around this. So, and it has to do with the Operation Prosperity Guardian versus Operation Artemis versus Operation Impact. So Canada is involved in U.S. operations in the Middle East through a number of different channels. And Prosperity Guardian, I believe the number I saw was that, six Canadians were involved in some sort of support role. And you're right, no planes or ships. But I believe we have a bigger role in Operation, or well, what we call Operation Artemis, which is the U.S. Task Force 150. And it's a combined Task Force 150. A Canadian actually was put in charge of Task Force 150 as of January 17th. And at least 27 Canadians are active through Operation Artemis in this sort of military engagement at the moment. And I believe there may be sort of additional Canadian infrastructure involved. So yeah, there's sort of the Prosperity Guardian is just one piece of a multifaceted engagement that Canada has definitely been supporting for a number of years now.
Yeah, I'm just looking for the global affairs thing on the Canadian involvement. I seem to have erased it somewhere along the way. But I am looking at one that's talking about Canada sanctions individuals affiliated with Hamas. The Canadian response, and this is from yesterday, Minister Melanie Joly, or Genocide Joly, as we like to call her in this country, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, her reactions to what's going on in Israel, or in Gaza more properly, at the hand of Israel, have been entirely pro-Israel. They have flown in, her statements have flown in the face of proven reality. A recent tweet by her, she is regurgitating still the use of rape as a weapon during the October 7th Hamas attack across the wall, something that has been debunked quite broadly in the sources that I read. It's old news, but I suppose for some mainstream sources, they're still not getting around to it. Is this the kind of complicity that your article is trying to get to, that or active participation, when we've got cheerleaders like the minister repeating propaganda tropes from the side committing this atrocity?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, you started that question by mentioning the new sanctions that Joly issued against Hamas leaders. This sort of like absurd political theater. Hamas is already designated a terrorist organization by Canada. So they're achieving literally nothing with this statement other than, you know, coming out and saying, yes, we continue to support the genocide of Palestine. And, you know, at the same, I guess, in a more materially impactful way, the UNRWA funding withdrawal was another instance of this, right, where it came out the same day as the International Court of Justice issued its provisional ruling. And then these allegations come out and Canada, the U.S. and a couple other countries immediately withdraw all funding from the aid agency that is literally keeping 2 million people alive. It's just like absurdly cynical use of Canada's platform to continue to run cover for Israel, to continue to support U.S. engagements in the region, and to continue to ensure that Palestinians keep dying.
When I mentioned, Nick, at the top, that a lot has changed since your article came out, that ruling at the International Court of Justice was probably the biggest thing. And as you mentioned, simultaneous to that was this phonied up report, I would say, about UNRWA and the allegations of UNRWA staff members taking part in the raid over the wall on October 7th. These so-called the allegations include by Israel, by the Israeli military, those that are dropping all the bombs and killing all the people, incidentally, are openly said to be the result of interrogation, which says to me that they grabbed some people that worked for UNRWA while their stormtroopers were moving in, tortured them into saying that, oh yeah, we were involved. And then they're trying to leverage that to make the huge leap of logic that then therefore the UNRWA is responsible and all of its funding should be cut at the most dire moment possible. And it's worked so far. 18 countries, including Canada, have gone along. Nicaragua now has brought forth a suit at the ICJ too against Canada for complicity, the very thing that your article is talking about. What's your reaction to Nicaragua's suit?
Yeah, I mean, more power to them, right? I'm glad they're doing it. I think it's sort of the latest step in what's shaping up to be a global South revolt against the imperialist world order led by the U.S. And it's some of the most inspiring sort of rejections of U.S. hegemony that I've seen in my lifetime. All that said, I think these actions at the International Court of Justice, as useful as they are, for those of us doing activism for Palestinians fighting for their lives, they also highlight the impotence that these international institutions have. You know, and I've seen some activists say, oh, they highlight how these institutions just exist to support U.S. hegemony. And I actually think that's wrong. I want to push back on that a little bit, because in the immediate post-war era, you know, the U.N. and these institutions were meant to be the birth of a new democracy led by the third world, led by the global majority, right? And these institutions were created with sort of like global democracy in mind, with the global South, empowerment of the global South in mind. But of course, what happened over the succeeding 80 years is that they became tools of U.S. hegemony. They were taken over. A number of other international institutions, like the World Trade Organization and so on, were created to further entrench North-South dependency or South, you know, dependency and sort of neocolonialism. And so all that is to say, I think these institutions are important for us to try to use. I'm glad that countries like South Africa and Nicaragua are doing them, and that we're all fighting to make sure that these rulings actually have a meaning when they come through. But I think they also highlight the degree to which the U.S. has hijacked the post-war global institutions and made a world of global South emancipation totally impossible.
So, Nick, we're fast running out of time. One thing I would say about your article, and again, it's Canada has gone from complicity through silence to active participation in genocide. I've interviewed Yves Engler many times, and he's probably the most knowledgeable person on the planet about the history of Canadian foreign policy in the last century, for sure. And he talks about the thing, you know, I would argue that the active participation by Canada in this genocide has gone on all along. I mean, yes, our complicity has been silent and has been kept in the shadows, but Canada has been active in what's going on in Palestine, against Palestine, in many different ways from the beginning.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, you know, not to give myself off here, but I'm not always responsible for the headline. But I mean, I agree. I think the headline is written that way. And I, you know, in order to highlight the qualitative distinction between us using our power internationally to continue to support Israeli genocide of Palestinians and all sorts of other horrific things around the world, specifically related to Canadian mining, but it's a whole nother story.
Yeah. A big one too.
But the Prosperity Guardian and our participation in these airstrikes marked, you know, a qualitative transition in our involvement just in the immediate term, and also made it clear, in my view, that Canada was committed to joining the U.S. in starting a major war in the region and being involved in it. And I think that was an important thing to highlight, which is part of why I wrote that piece.
Yeah, and it's an important one, and it sits alongside your other pieces at Canadian Dimension, Stop the Genocide in Gaza, Ecuador, just showing the world what it means to take climate change seriously. The climate emergency is a crisis of capitalism, and many others. Nick, do you publish in other places other than CanadianDimension.com, and tell us how people can access your newsletter?
Yeah, I am a columnist for Canadian Dimension, so that's where you can find sort of the most of my work. But I've also written opinion pieces and some investigative journalism for The Breach, Ricochet, and The Tie. And you can find my newsletter at sacredheadwaters.substack.com.
Well, that's great. And yeah, you mentioned the smaller outlets, and those are a number of the finest ones that you just brought up there, and as well as the Narwhal, which is one of my favorites. Yeah. Well, Nick Gottlieb, thanks a lot for coming on. And I urge people to go check out Nick's work at CanadianDimension.com. Thanks a lot for coming on, Nick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Well, my pleasure. And I want everyone to stick around after the break. I'm going to be joined by another Nick. This is a two Nick day. Nick Moturn, and we're going to talk about activism in the United States going from the courthouse steps to the factory floor to stop the war machine down there. Thanks again, Nick.
Cheers.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire. was imposed. No one could come or go. And in order to successfully throttle